This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hulu. Based on shocking true events, the new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, tells the story of a savage murder in a small town. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. This week's show, we recorded live in London, England, at the London Podcast Festival. We've got great comedy coming up on the show, great music, and interviews with the creator of Veep, Armando Iannucci, and the creator of the new HBO show, Divorce, Sharon Horgan. Let's get right into it. Bullseye, live from the 2016 London Podcast Festival. Let's go. My first interview is with a legendary comedy writer. Armando Iannucci started his career as a radio comedy producer at the BBC. He created shows like On the Hour and Knowing Me, Knowing You. From there, he moved to television, continuing to collaborate with Chris Morris and helping to make Steve Coogan's character, Alan Partridge, a household name in the UK. In 2005, he created a show called The Thick of It for the BBC, a show in which Peter Capaldi's character, Malcolm Tucker, elevated swearing to the highest form of art. Then he created the HBO show Veep. It's a loose American adaptation of The Thick of It. It stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus. At this point, he can basically build an addition to his house out of Emmys. Veep won another one for Outstanding Comedy Series this year. Here's a little bit of his British work. He hosted a show on Channel 4 in the UK called The Armando Iannucci Shows. Every episode had a theme. The theme of this one was imagination, and in this clip, Armando's talking about the fact that, in his opinion, imagination is what makes us superior to animals.
That's why I come down to the zoo at least once a day to laugh at the animals.
Tosser.
And taunt them with things that show how inadequate they are compared to us.
Look at that. It's a pen that writes in 10 different colours. You can't even write. I mastered this when I was 3.
Just look at these birds, obviously struggling with some quite straightforward books by Germaine Greer, and clearly not knowing what to do with a clarinet.
You know, it's our imagination that distinguishes us from the animals, because it allows us to come up with amazingly complex things like Dundee or Shirley Bassey. The most complex thing an animal can do is chomp or get run over. Isn't that right? That's why if you put Shirley Bassey in front of some of us and in front of some animals, we would applaud her and give her singing contracts, whereas animals would just use her as somewhere to piss.
Ladies and gentlemen, Armando Iannucci.
Thank you. That still holds true, I'd say. Still to this day, animals, I mean, they've now had 15 years to kind of catch up. And they're idiots. They're absolute idiots. They just make noises at moving things, animals. Which I suppose we do as well, but, you know, we do other stuff.
Like. Armando, I want to ask you a question about Veep, because it just won its 7 trillionth Emmy Award.
Yeah.
And it won it without you.
Yeah.
What is...
Why? How do I feel about that?
Yeah, I guess, basically, yeah.
I remember reading an interview that... it was Aaron Sorkin rang Larry David, because they both left there. Aaron Sorkin left West Wing after the 4th season, and Larry David left Seinfeld. And Larry David was asking him, you know, should I watch the new ones? And Aaron Sorkin said, no, because... they'll either be just as good, in which case you'll be depressed, or they'll be worse, in which case you'll be depressed, or they'll be better, in which case you'll be depressed. And I feel good about it, actually. It was something I always knew. You know, I didn't move out to America to make it, so I was sort of commuting, which was started off as hilarious and just ended up as ridiculous. I more or less made my final season while asleep with jet lag. So I knew I was only going to do a certain amount. And you know, I felt I had to come up with a system of making it that meant we could happily pass it on and actually give it to people who could inject a new, you know, burst of energy into it. What I've enjoyed about it is actually I did watch them and really enjoyed watching them as a viewer, because you don't actually get that experience when you're making something. You don't you never really know what it's like watching it for the first time. And what was good about watching Veep season 5 was I genuinely didn't know what anyone was going to do or say, and that was fun. Plus, I didn't have to worry. I knew I didn't have to look at a script or look at an edit, which was great.
It might be just like the American exceptionalist in me.
Yeah.
But why didn't you move to the United States when you started doing the show?
Yeah.
Like, you made a totally American television show.
Yeah.
With as little being in America as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I like America. But I also...
Thank God.
I also...
I didn't want to have to bring that report back.
I also like it here too. And I didn't... I'm 52. And at the time, I was, late 40s. I didn't feel the need to... If I was 20 years younger, I would have thought, great, this is a great experience. Let's go out there. Let's see what happens. But I kind of didn't feel the need. What I wanted to do was make that show. And I wanted to make it show... And I wanted to work with HBO. But I didn't feel the need to, you know, move to Hollywood and see what happens, because I'm quite happy with what I'm doing. So and you know, the kids were all at school and it didn't feel right to uproot everyone. And also, I think, you know, it's a very British thing to just do two series of something and then that's it. Isn't there a Simpsons episode where somebody saves up to pay for his a seventh episode of his favorite British show? And when we were on season 4 and our 40th episode, it was like a bizarre dream. You know, it didn't feel real that we got these characters to do something 40 times. And I think it was good for the show, actually, that it had a fresh burst of, you know, writers and fresh mindset. I think the mindset when you make something in the US, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the idea was always that you make a TV show and it becomes a hit, and then you work it to death and then retire. I think that's the... And that, for me, wasn't the vision, the dream that I wanted, really. So I thought, you know, 4 series is longer than I've done of anything. So I sort of thought I did pretty good.
When you got back...
Yeah.
Did you already have a bunch of things that you wanted to do with your newfound not-Veep time?
I got back and, I mean, when you're making the show, it's all-consuming. So actually, no, you don't have anything during the time. But the moment I got, literally the moment I got home and came in, and it was coming up to Christmas, and I got in the door, and my wife Rachel and my daughter showed me a Christmas wind-up dog that they'd found that just played a stupid song, but its lips moved as it played a song, a Christmas song. And it was so funny that I instantly got an idea, which we've now written into a film. So it's a, and it's a comedy about artificial intelligence, which... But, you know, the basis of it is that, you know, the software is great, but the hardware is terrible. I mean, if you look up these YouTube videos of robots, they are hilarious because they look drunk when they walk. Their minds are amazing, and they've got all sorts of algorithms, but actually the hardware is pretty embarrassing. So the premise is, you know, what happens if these robots have great minds and think, now's the time to strike? But actually... They mostly fall over, you know.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Armando Iannucci. He created the HBO show, Veep.
Any point after this 4 years of traveling 4 months out of the year to go work on the show and writing it all the time in the UK, did you ever think, like, maybe when I get back I should chillax a little?
Oh, and I did, yes. I mean, I wrote that idea down as soon as I got in the door, but yes, I then took about 3 months off, and you know, I find that always, yes, you have to decompress. After doing something very intense, you have to totally unwind. Yeah.
I want to play a clip from The Thick of It, which is a show that you created, one of my all-time faves. And probably anybody who's ever seen it, there's a character named Malcolm Tucker that's one of my favorite characters on a television show, like top tier, like I'm talking about Hey Now, Hank Kingsley level favorite. Okay. Character on a TV show.
And he's my all-time favorite character.
Oh, there you go. He's, yeah. I'm going to be honest. He's number one for me, too, but Malcolm's number two. And
do you say that to all the guests? Is your number two favorite all-time character relevant to the guest you're speaking to? So when Sharon comes on, you know, it'll be, I love, you know.
It's sort of like, have you heard of the game, the pickup artist thing? So you nag a little bit at the top.
And then it's always you. Hank. Hank is always.
Yeah. So, so Malcolm is like, he's a sort of combination of publicist, spinmeister, and fixer for the government.
Yes.
And one of the most distinctive qualities that he has is an astonishing facility with profanity. Mm-hmm. And this will sound like a television show to those people who are here at King's Hall in London listening to this. To those at home in the United States listening on the radio, it will sound like basically ship-to-shore communication, like a series of
beeps. Dots and dashes. Yeah. Okay, all
Let's
right.
Let's take a listen.
Now, get this into the noggin, right? You breathe a word of this to anyone, you mincing, and I will tear your skin off. I will wear it to your mother's birthday party, and I will rub you up and down her leg whilst whistling Bohemian Rhapsody, right?
Yeah.
No. Get out of my sight.
So that's not going to be beeped, is it?
Right.
Yeah.
So that level of profanity is a level of profanity and level of creativity and profanity that you also brought to Veep. So you've now spent like more than 10 years standing in front of a whiteboard, writing in synonyms for, you know?
Yeah, or things to go around it, I suppose. Yeah. there's a thing in The Thick of It, I can't remember the full phrase, but there's something called Tucker's Law, which again, you'll have to use lots of dots and dashes for the folks out there. You won't really know what it is I'm saying, but Tucker's Law is, if some can, then sure as that gonna because that and somebody sent that into me, all of that into me, embroidered on a cushion.
That like legitimately seems exhausting to me. Like I'm not being insincere when I say that like. That seems like it would be really fun for 18 months. And then
we're doing that
after
quilt.
That, you're just like, oh, I think I have to think of a new form of buggery. You know what I mean?
No, it's great fun. We usually, I mean, if anything, I have to kind of de-swear a lot of the script. because that's a great noise. Could we sample that noise and put it over Malcolm? because... You know, it's so easy when you're writing to just put another swear word in, but as you read it back, you realize, you know, the trick is to try and not make it seem lazy. So actually a lot of effort goes into the phrasing around it rather than the actual word itself.
How do you find the character underneath the pile of swear words? Like, how do you pare it back to the point where, I mean, these are really character-driven shows.
Yeah, and... Well, it comes down to the casting, really. The way I like to cast is we get people in who are comfortable. People talk about improvisation in the show, and it's not like the show is improvised, but who are comfortable taking the script and just loosening it up to make it sound natural, to make it, to dirty up in the non-pejorative way, just to make it sound messy. And that involves them not having to stick rigidly to every syllable as it's written. unless it's something like what we've just heard, where it's very specific. And, you know, Peter Capaldi, who plays Malcolm, will go away and usually on set, he's in a glass room, pacing up and down, saying his speeches again and again and again, to almost like train his mouth into memorizing the movements so that he doesn't have to think about it. But it is quite funny because you hear this muffled swearing coming out of this glass box that he's in. But it's to get a cast who are comfortable with that idea. And also, you can't have egos. You have to have people who are generous with a performance and are happy to riff a bit, but to have someone else come in with something spontaneous in response to something they've just said and not be thrown by it. So a lot of the casting that we did for Think of It and for Veep was just sitting people down and just throwing things at them and seeing how they coped with it.
Is it weird to write a show for somebody as important as Julia Louis-Dreyfus, like culturally important, somebody who brings into the show that much weight and specificity and
meaning? Yes, I mean it's kind of weird, but you know, when we first met, and HBO said, when we wrote the pilot, we wrote it for a female vice president, but we just wrote it abstractly. We wrote Selina Meyer, and HBO suggested that I meet up with Julia, and you know, I was a huge fan of Seinfeld. And she was very funny in Arrested Development. And we didn't know so much the New Adventures of Old Christine over here. But, you know, I thought she'd be perfect. And when we met up, I thought, you know, she would turn up with a cavalcade of PR and people, and we'd have half an hour of very polite conversation. And it wasn't that. She arrived herself. We met, had some tea, and the conversation just flowed. We made each other laugh for about 3.5 hours. And by the end of it, we just knew then this was going to work. It's you know, she just wants the show to be good and funny. That's all she's interested in. On set, she just wants everyone to be in a funny mood, because you can't make good comedy if everyone's tense and everyone's feeling a little bit tired and exhausted and worried. And so what's fascinating to watch, and I've just had this experience actually with Jeffrey Tambor, who's in my film Death of Stalin, which we've just finished shooting, that what's fascinating to watch is seeing someone who has an intense, huge background knowledge of doing comedy, so that when you do a scene, you know, she's able to offer 5 different ways of doing it. You know, we'll do one way and that's funny. And she'll say, oh, how about if she did this? And she'll do some kind of roll of her eyes or some movement or some little minor thing that's not in the script, that just lifts it. And it's the same watching Jeffrey. As I said, I'm a big fan of Hank in Larry Sanders. So, you know, it's just that exquisite ability to approach every idea with about 5 different variations of how it could be done, each one as funny as the other.
So, Armando, you just finished making this movie called The Death of Stalin.
Yes.
This is a comedy film?
It is a comedy film. It's based on fact. A lot of the events in it are true, but it is a comedy film. And again, it's a comedy ensemble. We've got Steve Buscemi plays Khrushchev, and Michael Palin is Molotov, the foreign secretary, and Jeffrey Tambor is Malenkov, who takes over from Stalin when Stalin dies, but is just way out of his depth.
Why? I'll just leave it at that.
No. Yeah.
Why would you make her?
Why? Well,
how many words do you need to finish this thought?
Several things. I was thinking, I wanted to make another movie. I made one about 6 years ago, really enjoyed it, and I wanted to make another film. Great thing about films, as opposed to doing 40 episodes or something, is you do it once and then you can move on. You don't have to revisit it, unless it's, unless it's Fast and Furious or something.
Have you thought about making a Fast and Furious movie?
I've certainly thought about it. I won't tell you what I've been thinking, but I was interested also in the idea of looking at dictatorship. You know, how does somebody come along from nowhere and through sheer dint of his warped personality completely change and transform a country. And obviously nothing like this happens now. But, you know, how does someone instill a fear of terror across the country? And then what happens when that person dies? Does that atmosphere still exist? Do people still live under the shadow of that person? But it's interesting that sort of Stalin, between Stalin and Hitler, Stalin has kind of won. You can make jokes about Stalin, or you can affectionately call, you know, if you've got, you know, someone who's a bit revolutionary, you can call him, you old communist, in a way that you can't say, you Nazi.
You know? Is it, do you think that...
You silly, silly Nazi.
Do you think that it was sort of like...
What a ridiculous racist you are.
The joke about the two guys running from the bear, and one of them turns to the other and says, "How are we going to outrun a bear?" And the other guy says, "I don't have to outrun a bear. I just have to outrun you."
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that Stalin and Hitler ever had that conversation with regard to their legacies?
And underneath it all is, you know, he had the Great Terror, which is like they just, on a nightly basis, drew up a list of names. Of people who got just rounded up and taken away for interrogation and exile. And you could be rounded up for, someone could report you if you accidentally put a coffee mug down on a photograph of Stalin on the newspaper. If somebody spotted you doing that, they would pass your name on and you'd get rounded up into. So there's an element of that. As I say, it's a comedy. And as I say, this, you know, a massive narcissist taking over a country and arriving at absolute power is not something that would happen today. It might happen in a few weeks' time, but not today.
Armando Iannucci, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much, Armando.
Thank you.
I literally... We asked Armando in an email, do you have anything to promote? And he emailed back, not that I know of. So I guess just go on YouTube to watch the Armando Iannucci shows. Somebody put them on there, and they're real funny.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. After the break, a set from the award-winning comedian Josie Long. Plus, my interview with the creator of the new HBO show Divorce, Sharon Horgan, and music from Romare. It's Bullseye, recorded live in London, England. From MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for Bullseye and the following message comes from Blue Headphones. For 20 years, many of your favorite artists have used Blue microphones in the studio. Now, Blue's radical headphone design lets you hear new details in your favorite music. Find out why Esquire magazine called them the perfect headphones. Visit the store at blue-headphones.com and use coupon code NPR for a special price. Blue, carpe eardrum. Take Bullseye and More with you with the NPR One app. NPR One finds you the best from public radio and beyond. Election essentials, local stories, and your favorite podcasts. NPR One is ready to make a trip, waiting in line, or waiting for a friend better. Find NPR One on your app store.
Ty is a pedantic person. I think when he pronounces these words, it's in a very show-offy way. Gyro.
Gyro.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu.
Ayers Rock.
Uluru.
What you are witnessing is real. The participants are not actors. They are actual litigants with real cases. They call in via Skype to Judge John Hodgman's court, the real people's court. Now I call you to Judge John Hodgman's Internet Court. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We recorded this episode of the show live in London, and our next guest is a London resident, an award-winning comedian, Josie Long. So I saw this movie that she made for BBC Three a few weeks ago. It's called Top 10 Opinions That May or May Not Have Gotten Josie Long Dumped. If you haven't seen it, go treat yourself to 4 amazing minutes of film. You can find Josie's other films and her tour dates at josielong.com. Ladies and gentlemen, Josie Long.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be part of this show. Hi. Also, I was thinking about the fact that we're in England, bad luck us, and that this is an American show, and I was trying to think, like, what can I do that might cross over? And I know that it's a really politically uncertain time for us here and for you guys in the States, and I've been reading this book that I've got here. You can, the audience can attest that I'm not just miming. And it's called Hope in the Dark, and it's by Rebecca Solnit, and it's giving me life. Okay, it's been so helpful, and I've been recommending it to everyone, despite the fact that I'm only about halfway through, which is a gamble. I'm just so scared that I'll get to the final page and she'll say, "And the true hope in the dark is white supremacy." And I'm like, "No, no, you made me look a right plum." So I thought I'd read you a bit of that later. But I was thinking as well, like, because it's so difficult when there's stuff that is so politically divisive going on, you know? It's so hard to think, like, after Brexit, sorry to talk about Brexit. Do you guys remember Brexit? The worst thing that ever happened to all of us, do you remember? Do you remember it? When the dark heart of our country was exposed to be rotten, rotten, rotten to the core, do you remember? Do you remember that? Sorry to talk about Brexit. I started calling it Brexit. It makes it sound more continental. So sad. But after Brexit, I kept saying to my friends, "We're all still here." And to begin with, I think I thought that I meant that in like a lefty way, like, "Oh, the lefties are still here." And now I started to realise it means, "Oh, we're all still here. And we have to keep going." And it reminds me of this quote from To Kill a Mockingbird, it's such a brilliant book, such an important book. And in it, Atticus Finch is defending this man who he knows is put up on trial for trumped up charges. And he knows that he's defending him against everyone that he knows from his town. And in it, he says to his daughter, and the quote has just been like so resonant with me, and I thought I'd share it with you. What he says is, he says, "I'm going to get that bloody bird." Not one of you has read that book. Not one of you has bothered reading that book. Seriously. That book is on the GCSE syllabus. Not one of you could... Not one of you is like, "Oh, excuse me, that's actually wrong." Is it, you know? It's obviously not the real... Why would... It's not even relevant to what I said beforehand. Stupid. I just said a stupid thing. This is the real quote. He says, "Let's kill the mockingbird." That's not it either. That's also not the... I can't believe that you wouldn't even pick up the second time. Like, that's the whole point. He says, "Don't kill the mockingbird." That's what he says. Like, the quote is, the real quote, he says, "We have to remember to kill a mockingbird." It's not. I'm so sorry. That's not the quote. I just couldn't help myself. What he says is, "Why is that bird looking at me like that? You better tell that bird it's a dead bird walking. You tell that bird to come down here and look at me like that, because I'm going to get it, stupid bird. Stupid bloody bird. Get it out. Get it out. I'll get it." I'm so sorry. Because that's not it. And I feel like loads of you just aren't even on board with this. And I've only got 10 minutes and I just really want to do this for the whole 10 minutes, but I know that it's not right and it's not good enough. But I will do the 100% real quote. What he says: "We have to remember when we are done fighting these people to kill that bloody bird." Get it? No, he doesn't. I'm so sorry. He says, "That bird." No, he doesn't. He says, "Get that bird away from me!" He doesn't. What he says: "We have to remember when we are done fighting these people..." Look at that, but no! I'm so sorry. What he says is, "We have to remember when we are done fighting these people that they are still our friends." And also... I can't remember the rest, but it's good. Also, hello, my name's Josie Long, I'm 34 years old. Thank you, prime of life, I love it, I feel good about it, but I also feel freaked out that some sexism things are like kicking in and I'm scared, and the way that I'm counteracting that fear is I've adopted this persona, and the persona is like, "I'm like a fun mum with no kids, woo!" Woo! get me a glass of Pinot Grigio. Woo! I thought that was just a stereotype. And then the day I turned 34, I was like, oh, I know what drink to order. Get me a Pinot Grigio. Woo! Shit on the Grigio. That's what I like to say. Who's on the Grigio? Shit on the Grigio. That's what I say. That's why I hope and wish that I was, I wish I was like a proper stadium comedian, because then when I came on stage, everyone would know that was my catchphrase and everyone would be like, who's on the Grigio? Who's on the Grigio? And then I'd just pull from my thing and, woo! Glass of Grigio, woo! All the 34-year-old women in the audience would start crying out of gratitude. Yeah, I feel weird about being 34. I don't want to, but I do. And also because I was a really good 25-year-old. I'm not bragging, but so good, like full of enthusiasm and wonder, but also kind of sad in a mysterious, hinted at way. So good. And if you're that good at it, you should just be able to Dorian Gray it after that. Just like, you won, you can stay, you can be 26 forever. 26 is an easier age to be in society as a woman, you know, like, how old are you? I'm 26. Oh, cool, you're old enough that I'll trust you to look after my house when I go away for the week. But I'm not going to spend 20 minutes talking to you about how we changed the kitchen work surfaces. How old are you? Oh, I'm 26. Ah, oh, I'll offer you some of this MDMA and it won't be creepy. How old are you? I'm 26. Oh, have you thought about when you're going to have kids yet? Oh, not really. Oh, cool. I'll leave it there. I won't ruin the barbecue for you. So, let me get this straight. You're 34, you're single, you want kids, but you don't have kids. You're 34, you're single, you want kids, but you don't have kids. You are... Time is ticking away. Time is ticking away. You are on a fertility cliff. I don't know you, but I feel like I'm allowed to say this to you. You are on a fertility cliff. You are looking over a cliff, and you'll be lonely, and you will die, and you will not fulfil your biological function. I don't know you. But I feel like I'm allowed to come up and say this to you apropos of nothing. Why are you putting sweet corn into a bowl? Because you're a good friend. I don't know you. Listen to me. You're on a fertility cliff, mate. You're on a fertility cliff and you were just about to fall off it and you better listen to me because time is... Please. I respond better to praise than criticism. Please. The way that I get better is by being nominated for awards. I mean that, please, please, I don't have to win, please. That's true. If you want to learn how to drive this particular motor, always the carrot, never the stick. Never the stick. Who chooses the stick? Give them the stick, whack them with the stick, and give me the carrot, and I will use it every day to make a salad for my lunch. Because I'm in my mid-30s and I'm practicing self-care. I wish I was a lifestyle guru deep down. And one of the premises of my lifestyle guruship is have a salad for your lunch. Oh, questions from the floor. Oh, I always wanted to eat more salad, but I don't know when to do it. Second premise, if you are a woman like me who cannot be bothered putting on makeup the whole time because you've got to do and because very regularly, on a daily basis almost, you want to do this. Put on a necklace. Thank you. It's changed my life. Like, legitimately changed my life. Like, I'll prove it to you. Look, look. Oh, look at that tired-looking... What? I was so excited about it on stage that once I ripped it off by mistake, there was a palpable gasp from the crowd. Like, the carriage was a pumpkin! And I'm like, no, please, sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm 34. I thought I'll read you a tiny bit of this. Basically... I'm so thrilled about this book. It's all about how hope is in itself an active thing, not a passive thing, you know. And when times seem really dark, actually it's a chance, you know, it's cracks in the status quo, and it's a chance for people to make positive things happen and wonderful things happen if you seize the day, you know. And what she says is, in Hope in the Dark, she says, hope locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act. It's the belief that what we do matters, even though how and when it may matter, who and what it may impact are not things we can know beforehand. And also, let's get that bird. Get it, stupid bird. I'm going to get it, hit it with a stick. And then we'll see who's the mocking me. Okay, not quite the ending I'd hoped. Thank you so much for having me. I hope you enjoyed the show.
Stand-up comic Josie Long recorded live in London. You can find Top 10 Opinions That May or May Not Have Got Josie Long Dumped, plus Josie's other films and tour dates at josielong.com. Welcome back to Bullseye. My next guest is another globally celebrated comedy writer-producer. In 2006, Sharon Horgan's show Pulling debuted on the BBC Three to much critical acclaim. When it was repeated on BBC Two a couple years later, it leapt from cult gem to mainstream hit. Last year, she debuted a new show called Catastrophe. She co-wrote it with the American stand-up comedian Rob Delaney. Amazon have already ordered a third and fourth season, but Horgan's not just resting on her laurels. She's got a new show called Divorce, which stars Sarah Jessica Parker, debuting on HBO this week. So here we go. Our conversation, live on stage in London, with Sharon Horgan.
Don't mock me shaking your hand. We literally can't play that on the radio. There's a lot of tone in common between Divorce and Catastrophe, but I think that, at least having only seen the first episode of Divorce, that it's interesting that in Catastrophe you are essentially problematizing this beautiful thing. Like, you were talking about the most painful parts of love and having children, right? Which are the best things, or among the best things. For the radio audience, we got a hand gesture.
No, of course, yeah.
Which, of course, come with these awful, awful, you know, sidecars. Mm. But in Divorce, you're starting with one of the worst things. So how do you approach that when you know that you can't just, you know, on Catastrophe, end of the day, like, you can show a brutal fight and you know that to some extent you will be able to get the audience back by showing some love. Uh-huh. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What happens when you don't have hand holding to cut to, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Gosh, it is trickier. I'm
sorry, I didn't mean to daunt you here.
No, now I'm really worried about the show. I think you're right, and also that becomes a little bit addictive as well. Because I think when I made Pulling, I didn't really care about that. You know, I didn't really care about making people feel happy at the end. I mean, we kind of went out of our way to upset people. And then with Catastrophe, because Rob is such a lovely, charming, handsome man.
We were talking backstage about how handsome he is. That's why she's gesturing at me like, handsome.
He's extra handsome today as well. Handsome. He just had an extra handsome face on. And but he has that sort of warm side to his personality, and so you kind of get a little bit addicted to sort of making people feel good or sort of rosying it up.
But he has that, like, weird Dick Van Dyke quality where you want him to, like, smile and, like, pat you on the back. You know what I mean?
No.
Okay.
So
maybe it's just us straight dudes.
I think with Divorce, I mean, obviously, it's the beginning of the end of a relationship. But I think also it's the beginning of her trying to find a way out of an incredibly unhappy situation, and for him as well. So I think there is some there's some respite in there, and hopefully it's not too bleak. I mean, it's pretty bleak. I don't think anyone's going to watch the show and go, I should get one of those. I should do that. You know, we definitely put them through the ringer, but yeah, it was harder work. I mean, I think it's sort of easier to write in a way because it's more my sort of natural disposition, but I think it's harder to, you know, keep the balance there with that subject matter.
Do you have too many jobs?
Well, it feels like I've got too many jobs. Mainly, yeah. But no, it's good. It's lovely having things come out. It's nice to make TV. I spent so many years, many years in development not making TV and just writing and writing in a vacuum and never knowing whether anything was ever going to make it to the air. And I was sitting writing with Rob Delaney the other day, and we just started laughing because we thought anything we write, we know it's going on the telly. It's such a weird feeling.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with actress and writer Sharon Horgan. Plus, we'll hear music from Ninja Tune's recording artist, Romare. It's Bullseye, recorded live at the 2016 London Podcast Festival. From MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks to one of our sponsors who bring you this message, HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed, along with step-by-step recipes for delicious meals designed to take 30 minutes to make, all approved by a registered dietitian. Everything is delivered in a special insulated box with free shipping. Bullseye listeners can receive $35 off their first week of deliveries. Visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code Bullseye on your first purchase. For an in-depth look at the Trump Foundation's finances, listen to Fresh Air's recent interview with reporter David Fahrenthold. He used Twitter to launch a nationwide scavenger hunt to find Trump Foundation assets. Also, don't miss Terry Gross's conversation with Bruce Springsteen in his home studio in New Jersey. They talked about Springsteen's childhood, his combative relationship with his father, and how he formed his stage persona. Find these and other interviews on the Fresh Air podcast on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts.
Mugs, shirts, stickers, patches, tanks, and more are yours for the purchasing at maxfunstore.com. Hey, you already love the podcasts, so why not take this to the next level and outfit your home and bod with our merch? MaxFunStore.com. Because if you have to wear a shirt, it should be one of ours.
Welcome back to Bullseye, recorded live in London, England. Let's continue my conversation with the creator of the new HBO show Divorce, the actress and writer Sharon Horgan.
I have one last question, and it's about the fact that, especially Catastrophe, which I've seen a lot of, or all of that's out so far, is so confessional and feels so honest and real. I wonder if and when you make a show about divorce, whether that is like terrifying to everyone who you have a relationship with in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is, apparently.
Sharon Horgan, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much, Sharon. You're the best.
Sharon Horgan. She created the new HBO show Divorce. It stars Sarah Jessica Parker. It's running now on HBO. Whenever we take Bullseye out on the road, we like to book a local musical act from the city we're visiting. Obviously, there were a lot of choices in London. The guy we chose performed from a pedestal standing among a huge array of pieces of equipment, piecing together his music live in front of us. His name's Romare. He's got a new album coming out on Ninja Tunes in November. It's called Love Songs Part 2. So, let's go to the stage of Bullseye live in London and Romare.
Hello.
Romare. His album, out on Ninja Tunes November 11th. It's called Love Songs Part 2. Every week on Bullseye, we like to close with a recommendation from me, your host. It's the Outshot. What if there was a modest rapper? A rapper whose whole MO was like, you know, you're doing fine, be glad you're here. That's Devin the Dude. You ain't the only one who got problems. You ain't the only one who knows pain. Get up off your ass and just solve it. You still got a chance to try to change. Hip hop's usually aspirational, or at least self-promotional. It's been 40 years of rappers rapping about how rich they are, how much sex they have, how powerful they are, how good at rapping they are. And all that stuff is great, don't get me wrong. But Devin's kind of the opposite of that. He's sly, he's relaxed, and he's high as hell. And he wants you to know he's doing okay. I mean, like, some troubles, but he's getting past them. And he sincerely wishes you nothing but the best. Like, this is a guy who recorded an entire record about his tired old car and how he's pretty chill about how tired and old his car is. In fact, it was the single from his album. I need some work on my brakes. My passenger side window, sometimes it just don't want to race. I hear bumps and crunks, pings and ticks and dings. I got a hole in my muffler and other minor things. Like my electrical rearview mirror don't move like a toaster. Even the objects in that motherfucker need to be closer. Most rappers are superheroes. It usually comes with a job. Like, think about it. Snoop Dogg is a character from a blaxploitation movie. Rick Ross is like a guy out of an episode of Miami Vice. Nas has all this lyrical wisdom to answer life's great questions. Devin the Dude, he's just like, it's cool, like, hanging out. There's a lyric of Devin's, actually, that I love. It goes, I smoke weed, I drink brew, that's all I rap about. That's all I do. It's not quite true. He also raps about sex. But even then, even when he's rapping about sex, he's never the conquering hero. He's just, you know, he's just a guy out there trying to get a girl. I'll just wait, cause inside it's much too stuffy. Gotta find something. The club don't close at 3. And if you're looking for me, I'll be sitting in front of the ride, drinking and smoking. He's just a guy hanging out in the parking lot of the club, trying to meet somebody. Even when he's dirty or vulgar, Devin raps with such a generosity of spirit that it's impossible not to be charmed. It's like a warmth, like James Taylor, only totally blazed. I mean, not that James Taylor isn't totally blazed. But Devin just wants to make it through his troubles, maybe get high. You know what? He wants the same for you. This song is a favorite of mine. It's about how grateful he is that he's a rapper. There is a shout out in it to engineers who smoke weed. This is for all the engineers who smoke weed. Can't forget about the production cost and all the hidden fees for another rhyme written. We spend time spitting in the booth. Sometimes it's like a pigeon coop, but it's all for the cause. Yeah, so I'm gonna continue to MC and smoke weed. I don't know. I guess the older I get, the less angry music moves me. I'm not an angry man. Honestly, I never was. My personal struggle isn't about beating down a path through the other people that are standing in my way. It's more internal. It's about finding comfort in myself, settling into my own choices. And when I get lost, I find myself coming back to Devin. I mean, I don't drink. I don't smoke weed. I'm an NPR host. But there's something in Devin the Dude that I think we can all learn from. Are you at a fork in the road? Can't decide which route to take. It's like the man sings. Do what the to do. That's my Outshot. What? That's the end of our very first Bullseye, recorded live in London. Thanks to all the guests who helped make the show such a success, Armando Iannucci, Josie Long, Sharon Horgan, and Romare. And a special thanks goes out to everyone at the London Podcast Festival, especially Sally Hollingworth and Zoe Jayas. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphone. Our producer is Dan Gallucci. Production fellow at Maximum Fun is Kara Hart. Our production assistant is Christian Duenas. Senior producer is Colin Anderson. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally, thanks to the Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. Sorry we missed you guys in London. Tried to make that happen. Couldn't quite make it happen. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And I bet this isn't enough for you. I bet you want to hear about more cool culture stuff. Well, check out our sister show, Pop Rocket. It's a roundtable discussion of everything great in popular culture, hosted by comedian Guy Branum. Hey, Guy, what's popping on Pop Rocket this week?
Hey, Jesse. This week we talked about the new sitcom from Donald Glover, Atlanta, on FX. We talked about just how exciting it is to see a TV show be shot somewhere other than the Valley, and the importance of having an all-black writing staff for a show that's trying to talk about real black lives.
I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator for Planet Money podcast on NPR.